and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors and musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophy. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com. Support today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, whose first concert of the new season is at 7:30 p.m. on Friday, September 28th at University Place Christian Church in Champaign. The program features Mahler's Fourth Symphony for Chamber Ensemble, a Mozart Wind Serenade, plus a musical surprise at halftime. More information is available at 359-077 or prairieensemble.org.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580 on Talk Program. I'm David Inge. Today's hour comes from Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind you will not be taking calls. In this part of Focus 580, we will be looking back to the closing days of War II and at the complex relations involving the three major players, the United States, Japan, and the Soviet Union. And the basic question that we will explore is this. What were the factors that finally led the Japanese to surrender and to bring an end to the war? Now, for many people, the immediate answer would be the atomic bomb, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the United States. However, our guest for this hour of 580, historian Tsuyoshi Hasegawa, he has a different analysis. He says he thinks that it was the Soviet entry into the Pacific War that was a decisive factor, and he says that he believes that this had a much greater effect than the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Also says that he thinks that in looking back at this period, that both American and Japanese historians have almost completely ignored the role of the Soviet Union in ending the Pacific War. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Tsuyoshi Hasegawa. He's professor of history, also director of the Center for Cold War Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of a recently published book that explores the subject. The title of his book is Racing the Enemy, Stalin, Truman, and the Surrender of Japan. It is published by Belknap Press of the Harvard University Press and has just come out fairly recently. If you're interested in the book, you can certainly find it in bookstores. Professor Hasegawa, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Just a very basic question first, and that is, why do you think that it is, as you note in the introduction, that American historians, Japanese historians, have given so little weight to the role of the Soviet Union in ending the war in the Pacific?
Basically, two reasons. One, linguistic, because those people who work on this topic do not read Russian. Secondly, paucity of sources. Sources were not really available until recently. So those are basic two reasons.
And I suppose we shouldn't really be that surprised if American and Japanese historians primarily focused on the American government and the Japanese government, and that it would take a Soviet specialist to do the other thing.
That's right. Well, that's right, Soviet specialist. But I think that in order to study this subject, you really take a look at three major actors. That's Russian, the Soviets, and the United States, and the Japanese. And it is rather difficult for one historian to do all those three factors, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I happen to be fortunate to possess the facility to understand those three languages and then also be familiar with all those histories of three countries.
You explained that there are three subplots, that's the language that you use in talking about the story, that here you deal with. So why don't we talk a little bit about each of those and in turn. And the first has to do with the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union, but specifically between the leaders. Initially, that would be Franklin Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin, and then after Roosevelt died, that would be Harry Truman.
That's right.
And Joseph Stalin. And
that's right.
There's a significant difference in the attitude and the approach that Roosevelt took when you compare that to the approach that Harry Truman took. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what was the thinking of Roosevelt and his advisors during the time that he was still president about what they wanted from the Soviets and what sort of role they saw for the Soviets in East Asia?
Well, I think Roosevelt, I mean, the timing is very important. At that time, until about February, until Yalta conference, the United States, we thought it is essential to secure Soviet participation in a war to force Japan to surrender. But by the time Truman came to April, this military situation drastically changed. And the U.S. Military, U.S. leadership came to the conclusion that the Soviet participation was not as necessary. In other words, the United States could do it alone. And so that's the basic difference. Another difference, I think, is the vision of the post-war world, how the Soviet Union figures the role the Soviet Union should play in the post-war world. I think the Roosevelt and Truman had a slightly different approach to that problem.
To what extent did concerns about Soviet expansionism shape the decision of the Truman administration to essentially go it alone and to believe that that the Soviet assistance isn't really necessary?
I think that was a very crucial factor. By the time Truman came to power, then Soviet Union, United States clashed over Poland and Eastern Europe, and then the Polish problem was the first problem that confronted Truman administration, and so Truman was really concerned about the impact of the consequences of Soviet expansion in Asia, and same thing might happen, and so that's pretty much the concern that the Truman had. Truman was in a dilemma, however, that on the one hand, that he wanted to avoid Soviet participation, but on the other hand, the military planners are telling him that Soviet participation, even if it is not necessary, would shorten the war, and therefore, to that extent, it is beneficial to the United States. So that he had to resolve that two dilemma. He was confronted with that problem.
What were the Soviet war aims in the Far East?
Soviet war aims in the Far East was not ideological, but basically geopolitical. In order to attain the security, the Soviet needed the territory. And I think that here at Yalta, secret protocol agreement, I think, was very crucial. That Roosevelt and Stalin concluded the Yalta Agreement, that is, that Roosevelt granted certain concessions to Stalin, that is, railways and ports in Manchuria and certain portions from Japan, the territories from Japan. And so, as far as Stalin was concerned, it is very crucial to attain those territories. I think this became a really important objective for Stalin.
Well, and as you say, this was something that a promise that was made to Stalin by Truman as a way of gaining Soviet.
That's the Roosevelt, I'm sorry.
Pardon me. Yes, indeed. A promise made to Stalin by Roosevelt, by Franklin Roosevelt, and as a way of getting Soviet cooperation,
That's right.
And the hope that eventually the Soviets would become involved in the Pacific.
That's right.
The Pacific War.
Yeah.
How did Truman think about the promises made at Yalta, and did he have some idea that somehow there would be some way around that, or did he feel that the promises that had been made to the Soviet Union about the territory that they could have would have to be kept?
Well, I think that as far as Truman's concerned, well, Truman's the policy is to follow Roosevelt's legacy and Yalta agreement was a part of it. Although that he, I don't think that he was really happy with the provisions. But still, I think that he adhered to that provisions. Okay, that we concluded, and this is the basis on which that he had to construct that post-war world. And therefore, that to that extent, I think he was committed to the observance of the Yalta Agreement.
Perhaps I should introduce again very quickly our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Tsuyoshi Hashigawa. He's professor of history and also director of the Center for Cold War Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And he has authored a book that looks at the closing days of World War II and at the question, what was it that ultimately persuaded the government of Japan to surrender? As I said at the beginning of the program, that probably a lot of people would say, well, that was the dropping of the atomic bomb by the United States. He makes the argument, that is, our guest makes the argument, that the decision by the Soviet Union to enter the Pacific War was a greater influencing factor on the Japanese than the dropping of the atomic bombs, and that really was decisive. And he makes the argument that this is something that other historians, particularly American Japanese historians, have downplayed. That is, they haven't given it the weight and significance that it has. And he lays all of this out in a recent book titled Racing the Enemy, Stalin, Truman, and the Surrender of Japan. And this book is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press, is available in the bookstore, and certainly if you want to read it, you can go out and look for the book. Also here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As I mentioned, you explained that, and as laying out the way that you think about the major themes here, that there basically are three. One we've just talked a little bit about, and that is the relationship between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, particularly between the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union. Another one of these important storylines has to do with the relationship between Japan and the Soviet Union.
That's right.
And earlier in the war, the Soviets and the Japanese concluded a neutrality pact, a non-aggression pact. That is essentially, they agreed not to make war on each other. Now, whether the parties that concluded that agreement, you know, how long they thought that would last, that's maybe open to question. But at least formally, there were pieces of paper that were signed by both sides saying that each would not attack the other.
Well, no, it's not non-aggression pact. It's a neutrality pact.
Ah, okay.
That is, that both sides would stay neutral. So that was concluded in April 1941, and even if the United States the Nazi attacked, Germany attacked Soviet Union, of course that Japan decided to adhere to the neutrality pact. And so that was the way throughout the war. In other words, the neutrality pact was in effect even 1945.
Mm. But would certainly the Russia and Japan had fought before, and they had competing territorial ambitions.
That's right.
And so one would imagine that for both sides, this was a strategic matter. It was, in a sense, saying to themselves, well, we're engaged elsewhere at the moment. Let's just say we're not going to fight this fight now. Someday we might, we're saying right now we're let's put that aside for the moment. The Russians were busy with the Germans, the Japanese were busy with the United States, and so this was a way of covering their backs and saying, okay, we're not going to worry about that just yet.
Precisely, I think this is a marriage of convenience. The Soviets try to avoid that two-front war. Japan wanted to avoid two-front war. And the neutrality pact, I think, was convenient for both parties as long as it's purposes. Well, in the beginning, Soviet needed neutrality pact more than Japan. And Japan was, although the Japan was concluded neutrality pact, they were secretly preparing for the attack of Soviet Union if the it's a favorite moment comes, for instance, the Germans just about to defeat the Soviet Union and Japan is going to attack. But the situation changed after 1942-43. The situation, the military situation changed drastically against Japan. Then I think Japan needed Soviet neutrality more than the Soviets needed the Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that's the situation. So as far as the, Stalin is concerned, here that the Stalin concluded Yalta Agreement, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what Stalin was looking for the chance to attack Japan, so that to make sure that he would gain the promises that Roosevelt had made. Well, but the problem is the Neutrality Pact. What is the Soviet government going to do with the Neutrality Pact? And in fact, at April, it's about just shortly before Roosevelt died, the Soviet government notified the Japanese government that the Soviet government is not does not intend to renew that Neutrality Pact. But the provisional Neutrality Pact was such that even if you have to notify 1 year before, mm-hmm. that the Neutrality Pact ceases to exist. But it's still, notification that does not mean that immediately it ceases to expect. It's supposed to continue until April 1946. And so that the Stalin used this Neutrality Pact, Stalin's own word, lull Japanese to sleep. In other words, that the pretend that the Neutrality Pact is in effect until next year. Secretly he was preparing for the war, transporting of troops and equipment to the Far East.
It seems that from the beginning, their commitment to this Neutrality Pact was not terribly solid.
That's right.
Stalin may well have been thinking about this all along, and actually even the man who had gone to Moscow to negotiate this and sign this on behalf of the Japanese government, it wasn't very long after that he was actually talking about invading Russia.
That's right. Both guys are trying to betray, I think, at the opportune moment. Neither side was really deeply committed to it. I think this is only continue to adhere to it as long as their strategic needs are satisfied.
Mm.
But the problem for Stalin is that, okay, that you have this this pretension that the Neutrality Pact would continue until April 1946, right?
Mm.
But the problem is, he was just about to violate the Neutrality Pact to attack Japan. How to justify the violation of the Neutrality Pact, particularly when everybody knows the Soviet citizens, and then everybody knew that the Nazi Germany violated the Non-Aggression Pact, right? But he didn't want that comparison. And so that's a dilemma too. That how to attack Japan in violation of the Neutrality Pact, and so that's why I think Stalin needed the American invitation to join the war. In fact, when Harry Hopkins went to Moscow and had a secret conversation with Stalin, and it is Harry Hopkins who promised to Stalin that the issue of joint ultimatum against Japan will be discussed at the forthcoming Potsdam Conference. And so that was very important for Stalin, because now that the Soviet government would be invited by the United States and Britain to join the war, that would serve as a more important significant justification to wage war against Japan override that neutrality pact. And that was very important. Therefore, that Stalin came to the Potsdam Conference prepared a text for joint ultimatum. I think this is a very important moment, important factor at the Potsdam Conference.
Mm. In this hour of Focus 580, we're talking with historian Tsuyoshi Hasegawa, and his book is titled Racing the Enemy. It looks at the closing days of World War II and the role that the Soviet Union played in persuading the Japanese to surrender and end the war. We have a couple of callers here, people who have questions, so we will bring them into the conversation. And anyone else who is listening, if you'd like to talk with our guest, you may certainly do that. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We'll go to that line first for a caller in Eureka, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. May I ask two questions, please?
Sure.
A very interesting conversation. One, I can remember reading a book about Truman and Potsdam, and your guest was just alluding to it, but it seems to me, from my memory, that one of Truman's top goals at Potsdam was to secure the USSR's entry into the war against Japan. Could your guest elaborate on that, please?
Okay.
Yes, I think this is... He was. he said that in a diary that the purpose is to secure Soviet entry into the war, but at the same time that he, as I said before, that he was bothered by this dilemma. That is, that he wanted to avoid Soviet expansion, Soviet entry into the war. And yet that his military advisors are saying that Soviet entry, I think, is necessary to shorten the war. And so he could not resolve that dilemma. And, of course, that at the first meeting with Stalin promised that the Soviet Union would enter the war sometime in the last half of the of August.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time that he wrote down that, okay, that we got the promise from Stalin. That's the reason why we came to Potsdam. But at the same time, I think that he was looking for the solution, the dilemma. He wanted to avoid Soviet participation in the war, but he wanted to shorten the war.
Mm-hmm.
And on the same day that he received the news that the United States succeeded in a test in New Mexico, an atomic bomb, I think here is the very, very important moment that atomic bomb became a really, really important factor in Stalin's calculation.
At Potsdam, Truman, in a kind of nuanced way, hinted to Stalin that they had a super weapon. Is that not right?
That's right. That's right. Well, I think that I think historians, I think sometimes interpret that Truman's diary says, okay, here it is, it's not atomic bomb. Atomic bomb was not. I mean, Soviet factor was not important for atomic bomb. But Stalin just. I mean, Truman went to Potsdam to secure Soviet participation in the war.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not, I think that in my opinion, the Soviet participation in the war was a security policy. What if that the atomic bomb did not work?
Mm-hmm.
Then I think that we would have Soviet participation.
It was more of like a psychological advantage. Would you say that would be true?
Well,
in the mind, I mean...
What do you mean psychological?
I mean, it was more to put fear on the minds of the Japanese at that time than something that Truman really wanted to happen. That's what I meant.
That's right, yeah, right. But now that he acquired the atomic bomb, and he had the solution, in other words, the dilemma was solved by the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that for the first time he realized that, okay, the United States has the possibility to force Japan to surrender before Soviet entered the war.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very, very interesting moment in Stimson's diary. He says Stimson wanted to explore the possibility of revising the unconditional surrender. He goes to Truman, and Truman says, well, go see Burns. And Burns says, well, we worked out a timetable. And this timetable, I think, is very, very important. Mm. Timetable is that I think the all factors that the Soviet participation in the war to prevent Soviet participation, we dropped the bomb before Soviet entered the war and forced Japan to surrender. I think this is the way that the Truman and the Burns thought about the scenario.
My second question has to do with, I believe, a history by George Kennan about Russia, and he said that in 38-39, there were some very large battles that the Russian army had fought against the Japanese army somewhere in Manchuria, Mongolia, that area of Asia, that were really quite on a grand scale, but never were much have been recorded or paid attention by historians. Would you have any comment on that or know anything about that?
Well, Japan and Soviet Union fought a war twice, border war, once called Lake Hassan. This is the Korean border in 1938. That was a decisive victory for the Soviet Union. And then 1939, it's called Battle of Nomonhan. This is that is a full-fledged war that lasted for 3 months.
Oh, I see.
And then again, from May to August. And this is, again, the decisive victory for the Soviet Union. And the Japanese military and underestimated the Soviet capability because I think they had this information that Soviet high command, Soviet officers were severely purged and therefore weakened. But it turned out that the Red Army is very strong. And that really had a sobering effect on the military, and then and therefore I think that's a very important factor for Japan to keep neutral even after the German invasion of the Soviet Union. There's a debate within the Japanese government whether or not Japan should really abandon the neutrality pact and join Germany in a war against the Soviet Union, or Japan should stick to the previous plan to go south, which really meant the war with the United States. But the military was in favor of sticking to the original plan, and they decided not to attack the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941. And this is a part of the reason is that the Japanese military had a due respect, proper respect for the Soviet capability.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, Tsuyoshi Hasegawa, is professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he is also director of the Center for Cold War Studies. And again, if you want to read more about this period in history, his book is titled Racing the Enemy, Stalin, Truman, and the Surrender of Japan. It's out now fairly recently, published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. Just again to, I don't know that we're going over this ground too close, but I think it's interesting when you consider that just how much changed in a relatively short period of time between Yalta and Potsdam. Certainly we had a change of administration, so we had a change of the American president, and also perhaps the looming presence of the atomic bomb. And yet it seems that things certainly changed fundamentally here in a period of months. From I think Yalta was in February and Potsdam was in the summer, in July, I think.
July, yes.
That seems like that to have very, very significant sorts of changes in the dynamics here.
That's right.
In a really very short period of time.
Oh, yes. Yes, I think things are moving very quickly. I think Potsdam Conference that the previous caller talked about, I think is really a great turning point. I think that the race, my title, Racing the Enemy, the race between the Soviet Stalin and Truman really began at the Potsdam Conference.
Mm-hmm.
That the that's, as I said, Stalin faced the dilemma that whether or not we should welcome the, or we should allow the Soviet Union to participate. On the one hand, Truman wanted to avoid the war and the war before Soviet participated in the war, and yet, in order to hasten the end of the war, that we needed the Soviet participation. And here, the atomic bomb played a very, very important role. And then the Truman's convinced that the United States has a chance to end the war before Soviet enter the war. I think that's a very important part. Mm.
Well, let's just, I have some callers here, and I promise these folks will get to them, but let's just, again, sort of underline that point. I think perhaps, probably, if we went out and we asked people the question, well, why do you think that Harry Truman decided to drop the atomic bombs, the answer would come back, well, because he thought that that would end the war. It would force the Japanese to surrender, and that certainly had to be a primary aim, one of the things that was uppermost in Truman's mind. However, at the same time, you're adding in this other element, that is, that well, on the one hand, that Truman wanted the looming threat of the Soviet entry into the war as a way of putting pressure on the Japanese. He was also concerned with Soviet expansion and didn't really want them to enter the war. So part of what would have been in his mind was the idea is we drop the bombs, we get the Japanese to surrender quickly now before the Soviets can become involved. So that would say then would argue that a secondary aim, and I don't know how you rank these two things, but a secondary aim would indeed be ultimately to block Soviet expansionism.
That's I think that's very true. I mean, that's I think the title of my book, Raising the Enemy, I think this is very important because it becomes very important. Stalin and Truman are racing. Mm-hmm. Racing. That Truman was trying to force Japan to surrender before Soviet enter the war, and Stalin was desperate to join the war before Japan surrender, in order to gain, because at the outset the concessions that he promised, the trophies that he was promised at Yalta, is contingent upon Soviet entering into the war. And so that was a crucial race. I think this is a very important part.
Well, let me ask one further important question, and that is for the government of Japan, how they viewed these two things, one being the real fact of the bombing and its immense destructive power, and the yet uncertain but looming possibility that the Soviets would enter the war militarily. I think your argument is that here we would tend to think that the bombings of the cities, the dropping of the bomb, should have been enough and would have been enough to persuade the Japanese to surrender. Your argument is that it was not enough, that the thing that really turned was the decisive factor was then even after the first bomb had been dropped, the Soviet threat, the real Soviet threat to enter the war.
Yeah, that's right. Because I think in order to understand how Japan reacted to the atomic bomb and Soviet entry into the war, you have to understand the psychology or the hierarchy of values that policymakers held at that time. We might think that the damage that we inflict with atomic bomb on Japanese people lives will be enough for all those policymakers to say that was enough, we surrender. But that's not the way the Japanese policymakers thought. There was higher value. The value that they upheld, higher than the sacrifice of Japanese life, that is the preservation of the emperor system. And that was the utmost of concern. By the time that the Battle of Okinawa was over with the defeat of Japan, that they were convinced that Japan is not going to win the war. And they started thinking about ending the war, but on what terms? And the terms, the one thing they held very high and sacred was the preservation of emperor and an emperor system. And therefore, the Japanese government could not accept unconditional surrender that it was demanded by the United States. Unconditional surrender was shorthand. This is the destruction of imperial emperor. And so that's why they decided to terminate the war through Soviet mediation. It's a sort of wishful thinking that the Soviet Union, of course, was the only major nation that stayed neutral, was not fighting against Japan. So that through Soviet mediation, that they could gain better terms to terminate the war, namely the preservation of the emperor system.
It seems difficult to believe, though, that the government of Japan, after the first bomb had been dropped, the hope was that they could still achieve an end to fighting and end with the preservation of the royal household. That was the thing that they were concerned about, and that they could. And it seems so difficult to believe that they thought that somehow the Soviets could still help. That is, that they in the interim period between the dropping of the two bombs, before the Soviets declared war on Japan, the Japanese were still thinking that somehow the Soviets could could somehow use the Soviets in the negotiation process to have the outcome that the Japanese were looking for. That seems far too trusting on the to me at least. It seems far too trusting on the part of the Japanese.
Well, in the retrospect, yeah, that's right. I think this is a failure of Japanese diplomacy. But the Japanese government thought that the Soviets. They will terminate the war through Soviet mediation. Well, that's why the Potsdam Declaration proclamation was issued. Potsdam Proclamation said that unconditional surrender in the first place and did not say anything about the status of the emperor system. They did not reject the Potsdam Proclamation right away, as some people said, Truman said, but they suspended the judgment. They decided that we still continue the mediation and in fact the Japanese government asked the Soviet to mediate and the Japanese government was going to send emperor's special mission to Moscow and trying very hard to gain to obtain the answer from the Soviet government. The Boston Proclamation was issued. And they said, "Okay, we will go." The Potsdam Declaration was issued. The first thing they noticed that Stalin did not sign the Potsdam Declaration. Still, that Moscow would be open. So that's the way that the Japanese government pinned its hope on the Soviet mediation. And then the first atomic bomb was dropped in Hiroshima. Did the situation change? No. Well, of course, it became urgent, of course, that it is more urgent to terminate the war. But by what means? Through Soviet mediation, right? Mm-hmm. And so that atomic bomb did not really substantially change the Japanese government. In fact, that the Japanese government's policy to seek mediation termination of the war through Moscow's mediation. In fact, that it became, the Japanese government was more urgent. In fact, that seeking that Soviet mediation, and in fact, the Foreign Minister Togo sent an urgent dispatch, sent a telegram to Japanese ambassador in Moscow, just try to get that appointment with Molotov to see how that the Soviet government would respond to our request. One day after the Hiroshima bomb was dropped, and so that it is quite clear that the Hiroshima bomb was not really decisive in Japan's answer.
Yeah, and it was 2 days later, same day that the second bomb was dropped, when the Soviets officially declared war on Japan.
Well, the timing is very crucial here. That the Hiroshima bomb was dropped on August fixed in Japan time. And the Soviet Union attacked the Japanese troops in Manchuria on August 9th. That's the 0 hours of August 9th, right? And then Hiroshima, Nagasaki bomb was dropped in the 11 o'clock in the morning on August 9th. So that Hiroshima, that the Soviet entry into the war was sandwiched between the two atomic bombs. Well, and so as I said, the Japanese government pinned its hope on Soviet mediation. That's why the Soviet entry into the war was really a great shock on Japanese, because that their hope was totally dashed. That the hope was it became impossible. This is the first time that the Japanese government confronted the issue of Potsdam Declaration, how to terminate the war. And so that's my argument, that the Hiroshima bomb, at least Hiroshima bomb, was not decisive. I think Soviet entry into the war was more decisive than the Japanese decision.
Let's see if we can take one or two calls in the time that remain. We'll talk next with someone listening in Chicago. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I recall reading, I think, in the 50s, an article in Harper's Magazine in which they the author stated that the Japanese had been in contact with the Soviets, asking them to contact the Americans for discussions on how to end the war, and that apparently the Russians never passed the word on through duplicity. What do you have on that, and what was the effect of that? That should have given the Japanese some indication of the role that the Russians were playing.
Well, the Americans had intercepted the Japanese diplomatic code, and then and decoded. And so this, you know, what the Japanese are trying to do, I think was known to the American leaders. It's called the magic intercept. And so that the Japanese government approached the Soviet government for the request for mediation, and it was intercepted by the United States, and Truman knew full well that what the Japanese government was trying to do. In fact, that the Japanese government sent the dispatch that the emperor is interested in terminating the war, and for that reason that we are sending that special envoy to Moscow, and could you please receive that envoy. The only problem for termination of the war was the Allied unconditional surrender demand, and the Japanese government could not accept unconditional surrender. If the Allies demand unconditional surrender, then that we have no choice but to fight to the bitter end. And so that was the message, and this message was intercepted by the United States, and therefore the Truman knew that if the United States demanded unconditional surrender, the Japanese would reject it. But when Potsdam Proclamation was issued, this unconditional surrender was included. In fact, that Stimson strongly suggested that we should include the British to the effect that we should allow that the preservation of some kind of monarchical system under the current dynasty. And Truman just eliminated the passage. So the question becomes that why did Truman insist on unconditional surrender, fully aware that the Japan would reject? And my conclusion of this, probably nobody has said that before, and this is probably radical, very radical interpretation. That is, the Potsdam Proclamation was issued in my opinion, to be rejected by the Japanese so that it will justify the use of the atomic bomb. That's a very, very interesting radical interpretation of Potsdam Declaration.
Can I ask another question not quite related?
Yeah, if you can be quick, because I got some others.
Yeah, it seems that the United States was following a policy of accepting the guidance of our military leaders ahead of everything else, and basically the military leaders were operating on a short-term basis so that...
You mean U.S. military? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that in Europe, Marshall recommended that the Russians recommend that the Russians be allowed to proceed further into Europe than seemed proper, I suppose. And this would be the case also as far as the Japanese war, the same sort of...
The U.S. military is concerned, I think that the task is to force Japan to surrender. I think they would, you know, they were planning to have this Operation Olympics, that is the Japan's homeland invasion. Of course, that they would have they would have been very, very, very happy if Japan surrendered before that. And for that reason, Marshall was in favor of Soviet participation in the war, just simply because it would speed up the process of Japan's surrender.
Well, I want to try to get at least one more caller, yep. And we will go on to someone in Crete, Illinois, here in line number one. Hello.
This opens a lot of questions. Are you saying, in a sense, that if we didn't have those bombs dropped, Japan would surrender just because the Soviet Union declared war in August 1945? Are you saying that the dropping of the bomb as a demonstration weapon at Tokyo Bay wouldn't have convinced some of the Japanese that surrender was in the teeth? And how many bombs was it necessary to drop before the Japanese would get the idea that they should surrender?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's a counterfactual. Had the two bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki been enough for Japan to surrender? My answer probably would not. I think Japan would have probably still trying to seek some mediation from Soviet Union, and therefore that Soviet participation would have been very important. Well, without Soviet participation, how many bombs was necessary for Japan to surrender? Well, I don't know. Would the United States prepare to drop the third bomb? The third bomb was supposed to be ready by the middle of August. And the United States was supposed to have nine bombs by November the 1st. Would Truman be prepared to drop all those? I don't know. To drop all those bombs? I don't know. It is very, very difficult to say.
And they would have not surrendered just because of the Soviet declaration of war. If we didn't have bombs and the Soviets declared war, Japan, you say, would have surrendered anyway?
Without the bombs?
Yeah.
I think that was a distinct possibility. To the extent that Japan really pinned its hope on the Soviet Union, and so that I think that's a distinct possibility.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, at that, I think we're going to have to stop with more to be discussed. Certainly, we haven't really talked very much about what was going on in the minds of the people who were involved in the Japanese government, but you can certainly read more about this entire story by looking for the book that we have mentioned. It's, again, titled Racing the Enemy, Stalin, Truman, and the Surrender of Japan, published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press, by our guest, Tsuyoshi Hasegawa. He's professor of history, director of the Center for Cold War Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And Professor Hasegawa, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to wyll.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Corn futures are trading, well, near unchanged at mid-session, as a rally in nearby wheat futures is helping to support corn values today. Corn was lower earlier on consolidation after recent price strength and harvest pressure, but the gains in the nearby wheat futures is helping to limit downside pressure on corn. Talking about that wheat, nearby wheat futures soaring on USDA's confirmation that Algeria purchased 330,000 tons of 2007-2008 U.S. hard red winter wheat, as well as concerns about persistent dryness in Australia and fresh interest in wheat sales by Pakistan and Turkey is also supportive to the market. Over in the soybeans, we're seeing some mild pressure today by the expanding U.S. harvest. The market came off its lows as wheat did rally. Soy stays underpinned by concerns about adequate soybean acreage globally for the upcoming season, as historically high wheat prices were enticing farmers to seed more wheat grain. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars in Kansas City. December wheat now at 875, up 10 and a quarter. March, 853 and a half, up 10 and a half. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 893, up 15 and a quarter. March, 895, up 11 and three quarters. May, 793 and a half, up 11. December corn, 373 and three quarters, up a quarter. March, 389 unchanged. May, 398 and a quarter, down a quarter. December, 416, down three quarters. November soybeans, 978, down three quarters. January, 933 and a quarter, down one and a quarter. March, 1002, down three quarters. November of next year, 938, down three and a half. October soybean meal,